Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Well, today is Tuesday. It's March 3rd. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard, and I'm so pleased that David Rubin was able to make time for us. He's the author of Trump and the Jews, and he was the former mayor of Shiloh, as they say in English, in Israel, the city in Israel. So good morning, David. Rather, it's morning here, but it's good afternoon over there. How are you?
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure. Well, the big issue for everyone who's watching Israel or is concerned about the contest, this is the third election in a year in Israel for the prime ministership. And it was very close, but it seems more people came out to vote for Likud, which is Netanyahu's party, than for the alternative with Mr. Gantz. So Likud went ahead, more so than last time, and over 71% of the people voted. That is huge, isn't it?
Oh, yes. It was a tremendous turnout for this election. And apparently a lot of the turnout was from the Likud voters, from the voters from Netanyahu's party.
Mm. And what is the fight about? You know, here we have three elections in about a year's time. And is the disparity between someone like Netanyahu as the prime minister and Gantz, who's on the other side from the blue and white party, is the difference all about religious Jewry and their input into the demeanor of the nation? Or is there something else here?
Well, that's a big part of it. But it's not the only difference between Netanyahu's Likud and Gantz's blue and white parties. The main problem is that, for example, according to the latest projections, Netanyahu ends up with 36 seats in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament. Gantz ends up with 32 seats in the Israeli parliament. Okay, there are 120 altogether. So whoever gets the most has to form a coalition with the smaller parties in order to form a government, to have a majority coalition. So Netanyahu is projected, along with his right-of-center allies, to have 59 seats out of the 120 seats in the Knesset. Gantz has substantially less. So there's no way that Gantz is going to be prime minister. But Netanyahu, if he doesn't form a unity government with Gantz, which would mean that those two parties, the right of center, blue and white, and the left of center, blue and white, and the right of center, Likud, if they would find a way of compromising and forming a coalition, then they could actually form a coalition even by themselves. But that's not likely to happen. And the right of center parties that Netanyahu is working closely with, together with Netanyahu's Likud, they come up with 59 seats. So in order to have a governing coalition, it's critical for Netanyahu to be able to pull some mandates from the parties that are either centrist or that are to the left. And the main centrist party is Yisrael Beiteinu, Israel Our Home
Israel
Party, which is headed by Avigdor Lieberman. And Lieberman has been, he's based his campaign on an anti-religious crusade. And, while at the same time, his views tend to be fairly strong on security issues. So he's more to the right on security issues. He's more to the left on religious issues. And it's a question of whether he'll be able to find a compromise with Netanyahu and his religious coalition, because Netanyahu has very strong religious base within his coalition. So if they can find a way to compromise with Lieberman, then Netanyahu will have 65 seats approximately, which would be a solid majority coalition.
Well, is it conceivable that from whatever parties that are left that aren't part of the Likud numbers of 59, is it conceivable to drag one individual from any of the other parties, even if they don't totally agree, and say, hey, we'll give you a position of some portfolio to just bring you in, and then they become part of a greater coalition where you get at least a minimum of 61? So is it possible to drag two more people from somewhere?
Yes, it is definitely possible, and that would be one way of avoiding the overwhelming challenge of getting the religious parties to compromise with Lieberman. So what would be the options? Well, one option would be to pull a couple of the more right-leaning members of the Blue and White Party, and if they would be willing to do so. The main candidates for that have already publicly announced that there is no way that they're going to enter a deal such as that. So it may not be them. It may be someone like Amir Peretz, who's from the Gesher Meretz coalition with Labor, which is actually to the left of Blue and White. But someone like Amir Peretz, who is the leader of that coalition, he could end up reaching some sort of accommodation with Netanyahu, because he would just have certain – he's very strong on social issues. So it could be that he would have certain demands having to do with social issues, or – you know, power to the workers, or you know, something along those lines. He's kind of like a Bernie Sanders, but if Netanyahu would throw him a few crumbs and perhaps give him a position, then he might be a possible candidate to break off from the left and to latch on to Netanyahu's coalition.
To ask you one other question, but before that, just want to remind people we're speaking to David Rubin, author of Trump and the Jews. And he was also the former mayor of the city of Shiloh, or Shiloh, however you want to pronounce it, in Israel. What about the uncounted or not yet tabulated vote for the military? So I don't know how many people are out there that voted and they're part of the military, but the distances are difficult and they may not have always been able to vote between a particular day or time. So everyone gets an opportunity to vote. Now, the question is not so much how many people there are, but is it conceivable if you divide where we sit right now, the projections of all the parties, is it conceivable that whatever is left in the military, if you extract the same percentage out of the military that was in the general election, is it conceivable that Netanyahu can get one or maybe even two seats more?
It's definitely conceivable. In the last election, after they counted the military vote, the Likud got an extra seat, and and there was another party called Shas that got an extra seat as well. It is very possible that the right wing coalition could get an extra seat or two once the military votes are in, and that could push them over the top. If right now they only have 59, if they get two more, so that will push them up to 61, which is a majority. And it's a very slight majority, but it's a majority nonetheless, and it would be enough to form a coalition.
Well, the third largest party that came out of this particular election is the Arab coalition, and did they gain or did they lose any votes from the last election you know, number two? How did they fare?
They seem to have gained at least one additional seat. They are projected now to have 15 seats as opposed to 13. And after the military votes are counted, they could go down one seat, which is what happened last time. But they certainly had a strong showing. There's no question about that. The Arab anti-Zionist, anti-Israel coalition was quite strong in this election. They had a big voter turnout, and they voted for the anti-Zionist parties, which have coalesced in that alliance known as the Joint List. But they're not very relevant. They're not very relevant in the coalition forming, because the only conceivable coalition that they could have been in would have been a blue and white Gantz-led left-wing coalition. There is no way that they're going to form a coalition with the right, and there's no way the right is going to form a coalition with them. They will certainly have the ability to scream a little bit louder in the parliament, but they're really not a factor here. The only parties or individuals, the only individuals that could be a factor in joining a Netanyahu coalition, aside from the parties to the right of Netanyahu, would be individuals from the Blue and White Party or from Labor. Those are the only ones who could conceivably join Netanyahu coalition.
Mm-hmm. And what about the other issue, a corollary to this whole vote? I guess, does it matter that there may be a court case against Netanyahu? Is that going to be put on hold? Should he be able to form his coalition and become the next government to succeed itself? Or is that not going to interject itself into the equation? He's going to have to sit and go through that process in the courts. I don't know from where I sit, and I'm very far away. The bottom line is I looked at some of the allegations against him. They seem to be they're very serious issues, but they don't seem to be resting on credible constructs. You know, it's like, okay, maybe somebody bought him a suit, but so what? You know, what did he do? He didn't sell his first child for that, or anybody else. You know, so it just seems like a little bit far fetched. Was that a political move by the opposition, whoever the opposition was? What is with that?
Well, they probably used their influence to try and push it forward. The left does have a lot of influence in the legal system. However, their chances of bringing down Netanyahu with that will depend on being able to prove that it is considered bribery to give to push forward a particular legislative agenda that a particular media outlet liked in order to get fairly positive coverage from the media. And that's a matter of some dispute. I mean, it could be called a quid pro quo, but some people, some legal scholars have said that it cannot be a quid pro quo. That you cannot call a request for favorable media coverage to be bribery. That bribery, by definition, has to be money or other material items that the individual politician is receiving in exchange.
Oh, that's fantastic. I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yes, that's something that Alan Dershowitz, for example, has pushed forward. that line of reasoning.
Okay, I didn't realize that. Go ahead.
So that's really the question here in the corruption investigation. But according to Israeli law, a prime minister could even serve as prime minister during a trial in which he is the accused. And as far because we believe with a vengeance that you are innocent until proven guilty. We are a democracy on steroids here. And we do believe in that motto. So Netanyahu, being the workaholic that he is, will just become a greater workaholic. And if he has to spend a few hours a week in court, so he will do that. And he'll continue to do his work that he has always done on behalf of the people of Israel.
I wanted to ask you one last question. The coronavirus, evidently, we just learned today in the United States, we had a few cases, and we now have two in the New York metropolitan area, one in New Rochelle, a city north of New York City, and another at a school in Riverdale. The Riverdale is the section in the Bronx, which is in New York City proper. And so two cases. And then I saw that in Israel, you also had some incidences like this as well. And yet I saw also that Israel, from a medical perspective, is really at the cusp of coming out with some sort of an inoculation against this. How is that affecting the economy or anything else? Because they're concerned the whole world economy is going down the tubes everywhere.
Sure, and Israel as well. Israel as well. It has certainly hurt the travel industry.
Tourism.
Yes, absolutely. It's something that the whole world is suffering from. Having said that, there is a team of Israeli scientists who say that they expect to have a coronavirus vaccine in just a few weeks. If that actually happens, it would be a tremendous thing, obviously, not just for Israel, but for the whole world.
Amazing. Well, I wish I could talk to you longer, but I know we're limited in time, and you're limited in time, so I want to thank you very much, unless you have some closing statement you want to make. I don't want to cut you short, or just to wish you a great day.
Yeah, well, that's okay, and I mentioned the coronavirus vaccine as being something that Israel is feverishly working on, no pun intended, and we're certainly all very hopeful. Israel has always been a light unto the nations with a disproportionate amount of inventions and discoveries and high tech innovations. But we are happy to share that with the world. And, so one thing that hopefully those who have read Trump and the Jews already understand that Israel truly has the interests of the world at heart. We're a little tiny country where we're always struggling to survive against our enemies, but meanwhile, we're trying to do a lot of good and spread a little light in the world.
Evidently, that's the case. Well, I can't wait till the next time we have an opportunity to talk, and I just wish you all the best. Thank you very, very much. Tada Rabba.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Be well. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, here we have it, folks, none other than David Rubin. He's the author of Trump and the Jews. And he was a former mayor of the city of Shiloh in Israel. Just a very, very compelling individual, and which is terrific. So let's quickly look and see what else is going on around the world. And one of the things that's really interesting is about the election contest here in the United States. And it brings in, of all people or of all aspects of our nation, Puerto Rico. So it seems that the Democrats are fighting for every single delegate they can, and they're eyeing Puerto Rico's primary toward that end. So So we're going to have to talk to Jose Roman about this. We'll have to talk to him about this particular issue. But at the moment, the murky outlook of the Democratic presidential race is not making one thing, or is rather making one thing clear. For the first time in decades, Puerto Rico's presidential primary is likely to matter. Can you imagine that? Workers on the island voted last year to move their primary from June 7th to March 29th. And with uncertainty increasing over whether any one candidate will emerge from the crowded field this summer, with the delegates needed to secure the party's nomination at the Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee, Puerto Rico's 51 pledged delegates give its voters more power than about half of the U.S. states to push popular candidates closer to the finish. About a month from the primary, activists on the island say Michael Bloomberg and Bernie Sanders appear to be the most aggressive in pursuing Puerto Rico's spoils. Well, the Democratic nomination process this cycle is going to be a battle for every single delegate, said Alan Clendenin, a Democratic National Committee member from Florida. Puerto Rico is going to be important because every delegate is going to matter. Well, voters on the island, a U.S. territory that doesn't get a vote for president in the November general election, only began participating in primaries in 1980. And that was the first and arguably last time there was any real drama in Puerto Rico for either party, with then-president Jimmy Carter narrowly fending off a challenge from Ted Kennedy and Ronald Reagan, losing to his eventual running mate, George H.W. Bush. Well, otherwise, Puerto Rico has been largely irrelevant to Democratic presidential nominations in recent years, an afterthought to contests decided earlier in the winter and spring. Republican primaries on Puerto Rico have been held on different dates than Democratic primaries, typically in February and March. Now, this year, though, Puerto Rico could find its delegates sought after. It has more pledged delegates than 23 states. Are you listening to this? 23 states plus islands. Lawmakers chose an earlier Democratic primary, hoping to return the debt and disaster-ravaged island to some level of political relevance and force candidates to address the island's issues beyond its natural disasters. And there is an additional reason for the candidates to make their case directly to Puerto Ricans. Campaigns on the islands could have a multiple effect this year, with support in Puerto Rico potentially influencing massive and growing mainland Boricua communities, including in the delegate-rich states of New York and Florida. Well, Puerto Rico shouldn't be viewed in isolation, said Federico de Jesus, a Washington-based political consultant from Puerto Rico. Quote, aside from Nevada and Florida, it's going to be one of the only Latino majority states or jurisdictions. This isn't just important for the primary, but for the Democratic Party in November. There is also the possibility this year that no candidate will amass the delegates needed to secure the nomination on a first ballot vote at the Democratic National Convention in July. And that makes every contest valuable, including Puerto Rico's, where delegates are awarded proportionately based on the popular vote to candidates who received at least 15% support statewide and in specific legislative districts. In addition to Bloomberg and Sanders, other major presidential candidates have given a nod to the island's importance. Joe Biden announced 24 endorsements by Puerto Rican lawmakers in December, declaring in a press conference that, quote, Puerto Rico will play a defining role in the 2020 nominating contest. Elizabeth Warren visited Puerto Rico early this year, or rather last year, shortly after announcing her campaign. Charles Rodriguez, chairman of the Puerto Rico Democratic Party, said the party is talking with campaigns about holding a debate at the University of Puerto Rico ahead of the primary, potentially on March 26th. That would be huge. By the time we have the primary in Puerto Rico, the race will still be open and many candidates will want to be able to grab a big chunk of the delegates of Puerto Rico, Rodriguez had said. Well, but the island has received only passing mention in 10 presidential debates. There is no public polling to gauge the race, and activists say they'd like to see more attention by the candidates to an island of more than 3 million people. One group of Puerto Ricans living in the States became so frustrated at the lack of discussion about the island in the primary that they, quote, traveled to Des Moines ahead of the Iowa caucuses to press the candidates on issues relevant to Puerto Rico. Smart move. Now, continuing, sometimes it feels that we're just a good talking point to hit Trump over the head, that we're a means and not an end, said Gabriela Medina, a national committee woman for the Young Democrats based out of San Juan. It's frustrating, she said, but election activity has been picking up. 30 days after the primary, staffers of Puerto Rico's Bloomberg campaign were bustling around their headquarters at an office building in San Juan's business district, surrounded by T-shirts, banners, and Me Gusta Mike posters. Well, so Deputy State Director Frankie Martinez said he's hopeful that Bloomberg's heavy media presence on the island, he's flooded it with radio and TV ads, will also have an impact on the primary race on the mainland. The Bloomberg campaign is also planning to send out thousands of mailers in Spanglish to target Puerto Rican voters living in Central and South Florida. Elections are won by very small minorities. A lot of Puerto Ricans have moved to Ohio, to Florida. They moved to Texas, he said. That's why Puerto Rico is so important. Talking to us here is how you talk to those communities up in the United States. In addition, Bloomberg's pro-statehood stance, unique among Democratic contenders, is energizing islanders who are tired of voting in referendums and plebiscites about their political status, weighing statewide against Commonwealth or independence that never overcome Washington's indifference, and said the campaign state director Francis Rodriguez. Everybody else says, let the Puerto Ricans decide, she said. Bloomberg is the only candidate who has come forward and said, I will commit to statehood and to the party. So this is our chance, end quote. Biden's campaign says it has a council, quote unquote, that meets regularly to map out progress and plan with primary voters, and a super volunteer, quote unquote, volunteering, or rather coordinating on the ground, a projection of the island's primary by the election and analytics website 538 gave him the best chance to win. Well, but activists on the island say, aside from Bloomberg, the only other candidate with an active base is Sanders, the early front-runner and delegate leader in the primary. The Vermont senator's sizable group of active supporters on the island call themselves El Junte de Bernie, or Bernie's crew, said Medina, the Young Democrats committee woman. We've done some 4 or 5 debate watch parties, and they always come. They're the largest group, always bien pompeados, or really pumped up, Medina had said. Sanders' campaign infrastructure in Puerto Rico is completely grassroots and volunteer-run. Many of his supporters worked on his primary run in 2016 and have since reorganized. They haven't assigned an official campaign staffer to work on the ground in Puerto Rico, said Marusa Caldeñas, a Miami-based community organizer from Puerto Rico who is volunteering for the Sanders campaign in Florida and Puerto Rico. Quote, but the support has tripled. We have a lot of volunteers who weren't active before. Now, Sanders campaign co-chairwoman, San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz, does not support statehood, but Sanders supports self-determination, a position adopted by most candidates that voters on the island should be allowed to determine for themselves whether to become a state. Caldeñas says that many voters view that as a way to not alienate people across the political spectrum and believe they appreciate his advocacy for debt relief and the disbursement of aid funds. She thinks the earlier primary could be one reason that Sanders supporters have been so active on the island, but she also feels the change in date caught other candidates off guard and is skeptical that Puerto Rico will see the kind of full-fledged campaign that leaders hoped for when they changed the date last year. Maybe it could have a greater effect if it stays that way for the next primary in 2024, Cardenas had said, but for this year, I don't think so. But Rodriguez, the chairman of the island's Democratic Party, predicts candidates who survive Tuesday's 14 primary and caucus contests will quickly establish a presence in Puerto Rico, and that is today. Today is the Super Tuesday. I think this is going to change after Super Tuesday, he said. The candidates will be looking at Puerto Rico. So, my gosh, well, very, very compelling. And just very, very important as well. So we're going to have to talk to Jose Roman and see what he thinks, and we'll see where all this goes. Now, this is interesting already. It seems that the betting odds are that the Democratic presidential nomination will go with Biden. So evidently that's where it looks like right now, but again, it's continuously fluctuating, so it's very, very hard to tell. But we'll have to see. It'll take a little bit of time, but Biden looks like at the moment that he's up 11.2 in different markets and to as low as 3.3 in other markets. And in some places, it looks like he's a tie. So it's going to be very, very interesting. So it looks like overall, Biden's at 49.8% on the betting odds, Sanders at 44.2%, Bloomberg at 8.5%, Clinton, I don't even know where Clinton comes in, but at 4.8%, Warren at 2.0%, Obama at 1.0%, Gabbard at 0.6%. Buttigieg at 0.3. So at the end of the day, it looks like the spread for Biden in the betting arena is 5.6. So we'll have to see. You know, sometimes these betting parlors, they seem to have a better idea of what's going on than anyone else. One second. All right. One second. I wanted to check some other things with you. And this is also very, very compelling. look at this. The Federal Reserve has slashed interest rates to combat the coronavirus impact. Just breaking news right now. So the Federal Reserve said it made the emergency rate cut to keep employment high and prices stable. So the Federal Reserve announced an emergency rate cut today in response to the economic impact of the coronavirus spread, trimming the nation's benchmark borrowing rate by half a percentage point. The coronavirus poses evolving risks to economic activity, the Fed's Open Market Committee had said, adding that it took the action to help achieve maximum employment and the stability of prices. The move comes after finance ministers from the G7 convened via teleconference with Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin to determine an economic strategy to defend against any impact from the coronavirus. So that's where we sit at the moment. Very, very compelling news, to say the least. Now, bear with me a moment because I want to go back to some other issues here with you. And one second. Where is it? All right, where did I put this? I'm not sure where I put this. You know what? Well, I'm looking for what I needed to talk to you about. Well, there's more stuff that's happening. You probably heard in our first segment with David Rubin. There is a case in New York, in New Rochelle, confirmed of an elderly man and who has, he's suffering from some sort of diminution of his health. So evidently he is now in a New York hospital. He originally went to the Lawrence Hospital in Bronxville and then was transferred to New York. And then there's a student that went to the SAR Academy in Riverdale, in the Bronx, a section of the Bronx, the northwest section of the Bronx. The school voluntarily closed the school down, and it's not holding classes. I don't know for how long, but we'll see where that goes. We just find out now that the health ministry in France says that they've confirmed the fourth coronavirus death in France. We also heard in the United States that there was a case in Seattle, Washington. There are cases that in Toronto, Canada. There were, I think, people in Miami, not in Miami, but in Florida. I don't remember the exact cities or towns. So all this is very compelling. And as we spoke with Mr. Rubin earlier, the amount of tourism money has been astronomical, and countries have been hit. Unbelievably, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank has set sides aside. The G7 finance ministers are going to confer today. Today's Tuesday. The World Bank and the IMF yesterday said they had set aside emergency funding for countries to fight the fast-spreading coronavirus as the Organization of Economic OECD. I don't think I have the name fully correct, but the OECD warned the outbreak could have global economic growth this year. It could have it, actually. So in a joint statement, the heads of the IMF and the World Bank said that they had prepared emergency lending facilities so that no country or health system should be short of funds to fight the disease. Now, the bleak forecast from the OECD group of wealthy nations, which could constitute a global recession, has led to promises of action from central banks and other international institutions seeking to limit the economic damage. Now, finance ministers from the G7 group of large economies are also set to hold a conference call today to discuss the economic impact and policy responses. So the OECD lowered its central growth forecast 0.9% to 2.4%, but said a longer-lasting and more intensive coronavirus outbreak could slash growth to 1.5% in 2020. The Bank of Japan said it would provide ample liquidity and ensure stability in financial markets, while the Bank of England said it was working with international partners to, quote, ensure all necessary steps are taken to protect financial and monetary stability. And two representatives of the European Central Bank said they stood ready to respond. The OECD called on governments to act swiftly and forcefully to combat effects of the virus, calling for support. Supportive monetary and fiscal policies to restore confidence. It said that governments should ensure first that there was additional fiscal support for health services, but also that governments should help cushion households and companies from sudden drops in income by, for example, allowing companies to delay tax payments, and more broadly, lower policy interest rates and stronger government spending can help boost confidence and assist with the recovery of demand once the outbreak eases and travel restrictions are removed. So these are major, major issues. So this is really fascinating. Then we got a big problem as well in the Middle East. But this time it's a little bit further from the Middle East because it's a question of Greece and Turkey. Well, the Greek army is staging live fire war games to deter migrants gathered at the border. The Greek military yesterday fired tear gas and staged exercises with live ammunition on the country's eastern borders in an effort to prevent the crossing of thousands of migrants from Turkey, deepening a standoff between Brussels and Ankara. Tensions rose after more than 10,000 people gathered outside a northern Greek border post without shelter. reviving fears of repeat of the refugee crisis that rocked the European Union in 2015, Greece has warned it will do whatever it takes, quote unquote, to protect its borders against migrants after Turkey opened its end of the border, breaking an agreement with the European Union that Ankara would hold back refugees from Syria in exchange for funds. Well, Turkey opened the gates to Europe last week after the death of 34 soldiers in the Syrian province of Idlib. Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Turkey's president, has repeatedly called for international help to stave off the Syrian regime offensive in the rebel-held enclave that has forced about 1 million people to flee towards the Turkish border for safety. Now, Turkey's already home to more than 4 million refugees from Syria and elsewhere, and Mr. Erdogan has warned that his country cannot take any more. The Greek Coast Guard reported that a child drowned when an inflatable boat carrying almost 50 people capsized off the island of Lesbos, the main destination for people being trafficked from Turkey. All the others were rescued, a Coast Guard official said. More than 800 migrants have landed on Lesbos, and 200 are on the neighboring islands of Chios and Samos. In the past 24 hours, a big increase on the normal daily number, the officials said. Well, Greece's defense ministry said one day military exercises involving units firing heavy artillery weapons had been carried out in line with NATO practices. Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission president, is to visit the island land border today with Kyriakos Mitsotakis, the Greek prime minister. Mark Rutte, the Dutch premier, said that the European Union would not negotiate with Turkey while having the knife at its throat, quote unquote. But Mr. Erdogan said the refugee flows would continue, despite receiving telephone call after telephone call from European nations asking him to close the country's borders. We told them the issue is over. The gates are open now. You are taking your share. So, unbelievable that this is going on, but we'll see what happens. And this is very interesting because I didn't expect this, but evidently Silicon Valley is backing Warren and Sanders. Donations from workers at big tech groups have favored Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren ahead of today's Super Tuesday vote, despite their threats to curb the sector. Well, oil prices have dipped, and they threaten Putin's promises. The Russian president's pledge of a $60 billion social spending splurge in the face of declining living standards that badly hurt his approval ratings have been thrown into doubt by falling oil prices. So this is where it's going to end up coming to a forefront. Just so you can see, the bumper profit at the Swiss Central Bank, the Swiss National Bank, has unveiled a $50 billion profit fueled by foreign equity investments, including Apple and Amazon, and a holding of more than 1,000 tons of gold. Whew, my God. Well, evidently, Slovak election winner is meeting the president, the Ordinary People Party leader Igor Matovic, who has spent the last decade assailing the establishment, has met Zuzana Kaputova, head of the coalition, head of coalition talks, after a resounding election win on Saturday. So we're going to have to see where all that goes, and very, very compelling, to say the least. Then there's so much to talk about. So let's take a quick break, find out what's going on in our neck of the woods again, and then we'll be back. Here we are. Let's find out what's going on at the Yonkers Tribune.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome equipped with a digital camera and a stenopad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. please call Hezi Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Well, if you want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, they've got one number now that makes it easy to reach them. The number is good for the office, for the cell, for the text, as well as to leave a voicemail message. So that number is 347-415-4326, 347-415-4326. So let's see what's going on in the reaction. We spoke earlier with about the coronavirus and the work that's being done in Israel. It looks like they may have broken the code and are going to be able to come up with an antidote for it within weeks. So that is very, very encouraging. Now let's look at what some of the impact is around the world. South Korea is seeking criminal charges against a Christian sect over the coronavirus spreading. Investigators in South Korea are seeking to establish the extent to which 12 executives of the Shincheonji Church of Jesus can be held criminally responsible for the rapid spread in the country of COVID-19, the illness that results from the coronavirus. He promises his disciples eternal life, fancies himself the new Messiah, and as of Sunday finds himself under investigation for homicide by willful negligence. Lee Man-hee, 80, leads the Shincheonji Church of Jesus, a secretive religious sect often described as a cult and seen as largely responsible for the propagation of COVID-19 in South Korea. 11 other executives of the movement are also in investigators' sights. Authorities want to know whether, due to its unorthodox religious practices and taste for secrecy, the Christian sect has put lives at risk during the coronavirus outbreak. With more than 5,000 people infected and at least 28 deaths to date, South Korea has registered the largest cluster of infections outside of China. When the new coronavirus appeared in China in December, South Korea, a technologically advanced country with a well-organized public health infrastructure, thought it would be able to curtail the spread of the virus. Seoul had already succeeded in containing a 2015 outbreak of MERS, another coronavirus, which had surfaced in the Middle East in 2012. But that was before South Korea encountered patient number 31, a 61-year-old woman who was a member of the Shincheonji Church of Jesus in the city of Daegu. She is considered to be at ground zero of the explosion of COVID-19 cases. Health authorities believe one in five of the people infected by the coronavirus can be linked to her. The woman first went to hospital on February 7 after a minor traffic accident, and during that exam, she complained of a pain in her throat. She then returned to hospital a few days later for treatment of a persistent fever. Well, doctors twice recommended that she submit to coronavirus screening. Both times the woman refused, the New York Times reported, but her health continued to deteriorate, and 10 days later, she could no longer refuse testing. On February 17, doctors examined her more closely and diagnosed a COVID-19 infection. They were never, however, able to establish how she had been exposed to the virus. In the meantime, the patient had managed twice to leave the hospital temporarily to attend the Sunday gatherings of the Shincheonji Church of Jesus. Each time, she had contact with 1,000 fellow faithful, the Japan Times noted. Her behavior is not surprising to people familiar with the church, said Chung Jun-seok, a South Korean expert on religious cults. To them, getting sick is a sin because it prevents them from doing God's work. The discovery of a hotbed of infection in Daegu, and the link made with the Shincheonji Church of Jesus was a turning point in South Korea's coronavirus battle. Authorities then came up against the very secretive practices of the sect, aware of the group's poor image within the country. The faithful often keep their membership secret from their relations, even from their parents. To Shincheonji members, their priority is not the safety issue, but rather protecting the church. Ji Il Tark, a Busan Presbyterian University theology professor who studies the group, told the Wall Street Journal, as such, in the province of Gyeonggi, the local government had to rely on some 200 volunteers from the movement in order to contact other followers, CNN reported. Because Shincheonji members often don't take phone calls from non-members. Well, the detective work necessary to identify everyone who came into contact with an infected member of the sect is all the more difficult under those circumstances, accused of a lack of forthrightness officially. They offered assurances that they were cooperating completely, but messages sent to members later seen by South Korean media advised them to lie about their membership in Shincheonji Church if contacted. The group's religious practices also lent to the rapid spread of the disease, of the virus itself. They meet often in small halls where they are huddled close together. Members aren't allowed to wear any accessories on their faces, like glasses or protective masks, because they are considered insults to God, several former members of the movement told South Korean media. Moreover, participating in weekly meetings is mandatory, rain or shine, and even in case of illness, members of the movement must clock in when they arrive and when they leave a working session, which allows executives of the group to monitor devotees' diligence. A cold or early sign of flu would not be considered sufficient to exonerate a member from doing his or her duty to preach the good word. Well, the movement is considered particularly aggressive in its proselytizing. Several places of Catholic worship in the country have posted signs at the door forbidding access to Shincheonji Church of Jesus members who are suspected of seeking to poach worshipers for their cause during Mass. South China Morning Post reported that. A sect leader, Li, was vehemently criticized for his reluctance to cooperate fully with authorities in their efforts to slow the epidemic. For weeks, he refused to take the blame, saying even as recently as last week that COVID-19 was the work of those, quote, jealous of the Shincheonji Church's success, end quote. But after the launch of an official inquiry, the octogenarian finally came forward with a public apology recognizing that, quote, although it was not intentional, many people have been infected, end quote. But is that mea culpa simply too little too late? Excuse me. A petition signed by more than a million people has been presented to the South Korean government requesting the dissolution of the Shincheonji Church of Jesus, which counts more than 200,000 members. Woo! Unbelievable. So there you go. And very, very fascinating sense of what's going on. Now let's look at Africa. Africa is looking to the lessons it gained from the Ebola crisis in its fight against the coronavirus. Their continent has so far only registered 2 corona cases, but sub-Saharan African governments are looking to their experience with Ebola as they prepare their fragile public systems for outbreaks of the new virus. In 2014, an Ebola outbreak stormed West Africa, leaving more than 11,000 people dead, mainly in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and also reaching Nigeria and Mali. Then the World Health Organization was criticized for what some saw as a delayed response to what became the worst Ebola epidemic ever recorded. Now the World Health Organization is holding 2 simultaneous regional meetings on the coronavirus in Dakar, Senegal, and Nairobi, Kenya, with the United Nations and international partners, said a source familiar with the meetings. Now, the objective, quote, share information, end quote, and then, quote, support countries, end quote, quote, pool resources, end quote. Only 2 cases have been recorded in sub-Saharan Africa, Senegal on Monday, Nigeria last week, since the virus broke out in China in December. So far, COVID-19 cases have risen to more than 90,900 worldwide, including over 3,100 deaths across 76 countries and territories, according to a report gathered by Agence France-Presse from official sources. The Ebola epidemics have enabled African countries to have a base on which they can rely in preparation for COVID-19, said the World Health Organization's Michel Yao. Yao, the agency's Africa Director of Emergency Programs, said that countries would benefit from their experience in border detection systems for suspect cases in isolation and treatment structures at airports. Health ministries are also obliged to apply the World Health Organization's International Health Regulations, IHR, which require them to be able to report epidemics and cases early, said Pierre-Marie Girard at the Paris-based Pasteur Institute Foundation. Confronted with multiple diseases, malaria, cholera, measles, as well as Ebola, most African countries are struggling with fragile public healthcare systems. Parts of Africa also face conflict, crowded cities with inadequate sanitation, rickety governance, and porous borders, all of which provide excellent opportunities for the virus to spread. According to the World Bank, health spending amounted in 2016 to $78 per inhabitant in sub-Saharan Africa, compared with a world average of $1,026, with a peak of $9,351 in North America, and $3,846 in the European Union. But the lessons of Ebola offer some guidance. With the Ebola epidemic, we can assume that health systems, cooperation and communication platforms, and monitoring have developed more, said Dorian Job, a doctor and program manager for MSF, Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, in Burkina Faso, Niger, Nigeria, and Cameroon. There is better monitoring, better follow-up, and it will certainly help. Well, there are possible vaccines. The Ebola epidemic is still ongoing in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, where it has killed 2,264 people since August of 2018. But no new cases have been recorded for 13 days, a development welcomed by the World Health Organization. The authorities, however, still have to wait a total of 42 days without new cases to declare the end of the epidemic. To prevent the arrival of coronavirus, Congolese health authorities are already testing the temperatures of travelers as soon as they get off the plane at Kinshasa Airport or when they cross the Congo River from Brazzaville. Now, the measures we have taken to fight against Ebola are the same measures as those we have taken against the coronavirus, namely hygiene and hand washing, said Congolese Professor Jean-Jacques Muyembe, the head of the anti-Ebola response team. With financial assistance from Japan, Kinshasa has also launched a, quote, diagnostic and research center, end quote, within its National Institute for Biological Research, the INRB. In early February, only South Africa and Senegal had laboratories able to test suspected cases of coronavirus, and the World Health Organization has since applied equipment to around 40 countries to help them prepare. And more than 300,000 people have been vaccinated in response to the Ebola epidemic in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, another illustration of the country's response. Well, World Health Organization says we're going to take advantage of the Ebola experience to speed up the COVID-19 vaccine and drugs, said Muyembe. And several companies and institutes in Australia, China, France, Germany, and the United States are racing to develop a vaccine, a process that usually takes years. Even though we did tell you it looks like Israel is only weeks away from coming up with a vaccine. In West Africa, health systems are still marked by the most serious Ebola epidemic in history and what they learned in the process. Our preparedness is better because of the lesson learned from the Ebola crisis, said Mosaka Fala, the Director General of the National Institute of Public Health in Liberia. Liberia has put in place, quote, 9 strategic pillars, end quote, to prepare its response to the coronavirus, Fala had said. All the people at the head of each of the pillars derived their experience from Ebola. This is going to be very, very compelling and maybe a lesson for the rest of the world on how they contend with this particular issue. All right, let me just see what else is going on. There's also other issues, of course. Ethiopia is chiding the United States for, quote, an undiplomatic, end quote, role in the Nile Dam talks. Ethiopia today accused the United States of being undiplomatic, quote, unquote, in trying to resolve a row over a giant dam on the Nile River, but vowed to continue with ongoing talks. The Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, set to become the largest hydropower plant in Africa, has seen a source of tension between Addis Ababa and Cairo, Egypt, since Ethiopia launched work in 2011. The U.S. Treasury Department stepped in last year to facilitate talks between Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan, another downstream country, after Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi reached out to U.S. President Donald Trump, a close ally. Last week, the Treasury Department issued a statement claiming an agreement had been reached and urged Ethiopia to sign, quote, at the earliest possible time, end quote. Well, Ethiopia, which skipped the most recent round of talks, denied there was a deal and expressed, quote, disappointment with the United States statement, but did not spell out its position on future negotiations. At a press conference Tuesday, Ethiopian Foreign Minister Gedu Andagashu said that Ethiopia would stick with the United States facilitated talks, but warned Washington not to rush the process or try to influence the outcome. The recent statement by the United States, we believe, is undiplomatic and does not reflect a great nation like this, Gedu had said. We want Americans to play a constructive role. Any other role is unacceptable. Ethiopia sees the dam as essential for its electrification and development, while Egypt, which depends on the Nile for 90% of its irrigation and drinking water, sees it as an initial hurdle is the filling of the dam's enormous reservoir, which can hold 74 billion cubic meters of water. Egypt is worried that Ethiopia will fill the reservoir too quickly, reducing water flow downstream. In its statement on Friday, the Treasury Department said that final testing and filling should not take place without an agreement, a position endorsed by Sudan. But it is unclear when future talks might be held, and Ethiopia said it will begin filling the reservoir in parallel with the dam's construction. Well, very, very compelling, and definitely it's going to be a big, big issue. Well, seems that coronavirus is behind everything. The Olympic chiefs are preparing for a successful Tokyo in 2020. Well, the International Olympic Committee said Tuesday it was busy with preparations for a successful summer game in Tokyo in less than 5 months and at a time when the coronavirus outbreak is widening. The International Olympic Committee, IOC President Thomas Bach, speaking at the opening of the Olympic body's two-day executive board meeting in Lausanne, Switzerland, said, quote, we are preparing for a successful Olympic Games Tokyo 2020. The International Olympic Committee, he later added, remained, quote, fully committed to and, end quote, and, quote, very confident of that success, end quote. We will continue this regular consultation with this task force to be able to address any developments which would occur. And many sporting events around the world have either been canceled or postponed in the wake of the spread of the COVID-19 virus. With more than 3,100 people having died and over 90,000 people have been infected in more than 60 countries worldwide. Well, the vast majority of cases are in China, but South Korea, Italy, and Iran have emerged as the countries with the most cases outside the epicenter. And the virus has infected at least 230 people across Japan and has been linked to 5 deaths. Following the board meeting, the IOC issued a statement in which it expressed its full commitment to the success of the Olympic Games Tokyo 2020. The IOC heard a report on, quote, all the measures taken so far to address the coronavirus situation, which was followed by a comprehensive discussion. Quote, a joint task force had already been created in mid-February involving the IOC, Tokyo 2020, the host city of Tokyo, the government of Japan, and the World Health Organization, the IOC, had said. Well, the IOC executive board appreciates and supports the measures being taken, which constitute an important part of Tokyo's plan to host safe and secure games. The IOC will continue to follow the advice of the World Health Organization as the leading United Nations agency on this topic. And the IOC also welcomed the close collaboration and flexibility between sporting federations, Olympic committees, and governments with regard to the preparation of the games and particularly the qualification events. All stakeholders continue to work closely together to address the challenges of coronavirus, it said. The IOC executive board encourages all athletes to continue to prepare for the Olympic Games 2020. The IOC will keep supporting the athletes by providing the latest information and developments, which are accessible for athletes worldwide on the Athlete 365 website. IOC President Bach earlier said that the board meeting would also be used to, quote, prepare many of the final decisions that we will have to take at a first pre-game executive board meeting between June 15 through the 17th, also in Lausanne, Switzerland. We will have to make some proposals for the session in Tokyo. The IOC executive board is also set to meet on July 18 to 19 in Tokyo, a month later, with the Olympic Games running from July 24 to August 9. Oh, my God. Well, there's a lot going on, as they say. Evidently, violence has not abated, but has rather flared up again as Chile braces for new protests. Chile's capital experienced its worst night of anti-government violence in weeks after stone-throwing protesters clashed with police in running battles across the country, across the city rather, forcing public transport to shut down. Demonstrators returned to Santiago's Plaza Italia on Monday to rally against economic inequality and condemn the government of right-wing billionaire President Sebastián Piñera. By nightfall, a group of hooded men clashed with riot officers in nearby streets, hurling rocks and firing projectiles with slingshots. One protester was run over by a police vehicle during the clashes, police captain Juan Chevy told local media. Chevy said that the driver had lost control due to an overwhelming number of objects and Molotov bombs that were thrown onto the windshield of the police vehicle. Elsewhere in the city, protesters built barricades and set themselves alight before being dispersed by police using tear gas and water cannons. Interior and Security Minister Gonzalo Blumel condemned the violence, which he said left 73 police officers injured and 283 people detained. Blumel told Chile's Radio Agricultura that the capital was able to cope with the protests until they got out of control. The people were able to carry out their activities, but in the afternoon and at night, there was violence, pure and simple. Acts of violence that have nothing to do with social demands, the minister had said. And Blumel said that the government had sought the advice of German and British police forces on maintaining public order and said that Chile would increase the police presence by 50% to confront protesters. Public transport was suspended in the capital around 10 o'clock local. That's in the evening. And for safety reasons, authorities said, and services resumed at dawn when barricades were still smoldering and traffic light poles lay on the ground into the city. And more than 30 people have died since protests began late October with the announcement of a modest hike in metro transport fares. Now, the demonstrations have mushroomed to encompass wider discontent over social and economic woes. Around 23 police officers were injured last week during clashes with rioters at the Viña del Mar Music Festival west of the capital. Authorities fear a new round of rallies this month with the end of the summer holiday season. Protest organizers have circulated a calendar of demonstrations, including International Women's Day on March 8th and the anniversary of the deaths of two brothers murdered by the former Pinochet dictatorship on March 29th. And the aim is to pressure Piñera's conservative government to expand social reforms it has already proposed in order to quell violent protests, which began last October. My gosh, there is so much happening around the world. We are blessed not to have as much discord here, but certainly there is discord as well. So we're going to have to see. We're going to have to see what else is going on. Now let's go back to Iran. Evidently, Iran is trying to mobilize an army against the coronavirus as the death toll tops 75. Iran's supreme leader put the Islamic Republic on war footing today against the new coronavirus by ordering its armed forces to assist health officials in combating the outbreak with authorities, which authorities say has killed 77 people, the highest toll outside of China. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's decision was announced after state media broadcast images of the 80-year-old leader planting a tree wearing disposable gloves ahead of Iran's upcoming Arbor Day, showing how concern about the virus now reaches up to the top of the country's Shiite theocracy. Iranian media reported that 23 members of parliament now had the virus, as did the head of the country's emergency services. Whatever helps public health and prevents the spread of the disease is good, and what helps to spread it is sin, Khamenei had said. After downplaying the coronavirus as recently as last week, Iranian authorities said on Tuesday they had plans to potentially mobilize 300,000 soldiers and volunteers to confront the virus. It wasn't clear if Khamenei's order would set them in motion, helping sanitize streets, direct traffic, and track possible contacts those ill with the virus had with others, as initially suggested. There are now over 2,530 cases of the new coronavirus across the Middle East. Of those outside Iran in the region, most linked back to the Islamic Republic. Yet experts worry that Iran's percentage of deaths to infections, now around 3.3%, is much higher than in other countries, suggesting the number of infections in Iran may be far greater than current figures show. Now, Iran stands alone in how the virus has affected its government, even compared to the hard-hit China, the epicenter of the outbreak. Now, the death of Expediency Council member Mohammed Mir Mohammadi on Monday makes him the highest-ranking official within Iran's leadership to be killed by the virus. The state media referred to him as a confidant of Khamenei. The virus earlier killed Hadi Hosrosani. Iran's former ambassador to the Vatican, as well as recently elected member of parliament. And those sick include Vice President Masumeh Ebtekar, better known as Sister Mary, the English-speaking spokeswoman for the students who seized the United States Embassy in Tehran in 1979 and sparked a 444-day hostage crisis, state media had reported. Also sick is Irai Haririshi, the head of an Iranian government task force on the coronavirus who tried to downplay the virus before falling ill. On Tuesday, lawmaker Abdulreza Mesri told Iranian state television's Young Journalists Club program that 23 members of parliament had the coronavirus. He urged all lawmakers to avoid the public. And these people have a close relationship with the people, and they carry different viruses from different parts of the country, which may create a new virus. So we recommend the lawmakers to cut their relationship with the public for now, Mesri had said. The semi-official ILNA and Tasnim news agencies in Iran also reported that Pir Hossein Holivand, the head of the country's emergency services, had come down with the new illness. They offered no other immediate details. So, okay, there's a lot going on, as they say. So we'll just have to see where all that goes on. Interesting as well, in France has shut down dozens of schools in areas hit by the coronavirus. French officials have closed about 120 schools in areas that have reported the largest number of coronavirus infections, and more could be shuttered in the coming days, Education Minister Jean-Michel Blanquer said today. Both primary and secondary schools have been shut in the Ouise department north of Paris, where the main cluster of French cases has emerged and where two people have died of the virus had lived. On Tuesday, the government reported a total of 204 cases, up 13 from the previous day, and a total of 4 deaths, up from the previous total of 3. The latest person to die was a 92-year-old man in Brittany. The Ouise closures are affecting about 35,000 pupils, Blanquer told LCI television, while an additional 9,000 have been told to stay home in the Morbihan department of Brittany on the Atlantic coast. Now, one class of some 20 students has been suspended in Montreuil a suburb just east of Paris for the virus, Blanquer had said, the Louise schools will remain closed until further notice, while Morbihan authorities have ordered doors shut until at least March 14. And these measures are evolving quickly, Blanquer had said. There could be similar measures taken in the coming days at other schools. Authorities have already halted all class trips outside the country and prohibited any gatherings of more than 5,000 people in enclosed spaces. Schools are increasing stocks of soap for washing hands, said Blanquer, as said there was no plan to order a nationwide school shutdown for now. It wouldn't make sense to confine everyone to paralyze the country. It would be counterproductive, he said. President Emmanuel Macron, who is scheduled to visit the Health Ministry's Crisis Management Center on Tuesday, has called off several events this week as France scrambles to contain the outbreak. And contagion fears have led to shortages of sanitizing hand gels and face masks, with suppliers racing to replenish stock, even though much of the production is in China, where authorities have closed thousands of factories after the coronavirus emerged there in December. Demand for thermometers has also soared, with one French producer, STIL, relaunching production at its factory south of Paris for the first time in 15 years after having moved manufacturing to Chinese partners. We can't do without China completely, but with this coronavirus, the balance could shift for French companies to not be completely reliant on Chinese producers, STIL's president Gérard Lux told Agence France-Presse. Well, the coronavirus epidemic shut down the Louvre Museum for a second day on Monday, with workers who guard its famous trove of artworks fearful of being contaminated by the museum's flow of tourists from around the world. It was not clear whether the world's busiest museum, which is closed on Tuesdays, would reopen the next day. Well, other events to have been canceled included French capital's annual book fair, Livre Paris, which was expected to bring about 160,000 visitors to Paris later this month. My God, it seems the world is crippled by all of this, and it's going to be very, very interesting to see where all this goes. Fortunately, the world is in uncharted territory as the coronavirus toll rises. The world has entered uncharted territory in its battle against the deadly coronavirus. The United Nations Health Agency warned as new infections dropped dramatically in China on Tuesday, but surged abroad, with the United States death toll rising to 6. Globally, the virus has killed more than 3,100 people and infected over 90,000, even as a clear shift in the crisis emerges, with 9 times as many cases recorded outside China as inside, according to the World Health Organization. Now, China has imposed draconian quarantines and travel restrictions to keep large swaths of the population indoors for weeks, a strategy that appears to have paid off as new cases have been falling this month. While Italy has locked down towns, other countries have stopped short of enacting mass quarantines and instead have discouraged large gatherings, delaying sports events and banned arrivals from virus-hit nations. South Korea, Iran, and Italy have emerged as major spawning grounds for the novel coronavirus, which is believed to have originated at a market that sold wild animals in the central Chinese city of Wuhan in Hubei province late last year. We are in uncharted territory, the World Health Organization chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus had said on Monday. We have never before seen a respiratory pathogen that is capable of community transmission, but which can also be contained with the right measures. Community transmission means infections within a population are not imported from another virus-hit area. The United States is now facing a potential epidemic, with 6 people dying in the northwestern state of Washington, where officials warned residents the battle against the disease was shifting from containment to mitigation. And we spoke to you earlier today. It was a case in New Rochelle and also a case in a school in Riverdale section of the Bronx. The risk for all, and of course there were cases also in Toronto, cases in Florida. The risk for all of us of becoming infected will be increasing, said Jeff Duchin, a health officer in King County, where five of the deaths occurred. The district is home to Seattle, a city with a population of more than 700,000 people. The White House, which has been accused of downplaying the threat from the virus, continued to strike a bullish tone. Vice President Mike Pence declared that a treatment could literally be available by the summer or early fall. He was likely referring to remdesivir, an antiviral drug developed by the pharmaceutical firm Gilead that has already been used to treat one U.S. patient and was moving toward two expansive final stage trials in Asia. Pence also announced American pharmaceuticals were teaming up in a consortium to fight the virus and said that South Korea and Italy, two of the hardest hit nations, would screen all their airline passengers bound for the United States. Despite its world-class hospitals and cutting-edge research, the United States is viewed as vulnerable to an epidemic because of glaring disparities in its health care system, including nearly 28 million people without coverage. China reported 125 new cases on Tuesday, its lowest daily increase in 6 weeks, with all but 11 infections in Wuhan's central Hubei province. The nationwide death toll rose to 2,943, with 31 more deaths, all in Hubei. Chinese officials have touted progress in the battle against the epidemic, which has taken a toll on the world's second largest economy and threatened to cut into global growth. Global markets tanked last week but rebounded on Monday after governments and central banks said they would step in if needed to soften the blow. Finance ministers and central bank chiefs from G7 countries will hold talks on the issue today. United Nations medical experts arrived in Iran on Monday to help it tackle the world's second deadliest outbreak, with 66 fatalities and more than 1,500 infections. China sent experts to Iran on Saturday, while Germany, France, and Britain pledged emergency medical supplies, bodysuits, and gloves. In Italy, tourist hotspots, including the Duomo in Milan, reopened to visitors, but access was limited to avoid overcrowding in a bid to contain the virus. Italy, Europe's worst affected country with about 1,700 infections, said on Monday its deaths from the virus had jumped 18 to 52. South Korea has the most infections outside China, with more than 4,000 cases and 26 deaths. The World Health Organization says the virus appears to particularly hit people over the age of 60 and those already weakened by other diseases. Its mortality rate is between 2 and 5% higher than the seasonal flu. Very, very compelling, to say the least. Don't want to lose sight of this because it's right around our corner. It's in the neighbor. Haiti's president has picked a new prime minister to tackle the socio-political crisis. Well, Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, yesterday named a new prime minister to tackle the country's worsening socio-political and security crisis. The decree naming Joseph Jout to the position was published in the official government gazette after Moïse made the announcement on Twitter, albeit with a different spelling of Jout's name. He spells it J-O-U-T-H-E. That's the correct spelling. Following consultation with different sectors, I've decided on Jout, J-O-U-T-E, Joseph, as the new prime minister, Moïse said on his official Twitter account. He is tasked with forming, as soon as possible, a government of transparency and consensus, capable of rising to the challenges of the moment, he said. Jout has been environment minister since September of 2018 and was also appointed interim finance minister in September of 2019. He replaced Jean-Michel Lapin, who has been acting prime minister. Haiti has been in deep crisis since the resignation in March of 2019 of Prime Minister Jean-Henri Séan. Jout is the third person Moïse has appointed to the post since then. Now, lawmakers have never approved any of his nominees, hampering the government's ability to function. Elections could not be held last autumn, and Parliament has not been in session since January. That means that Jout's appointment cannot be ratified according to constitutional rules. And political talks that began last summer to find a way to form a new government came to nothing, and the opposition is demanding that Moïse step down before any further discussion can even begin. Popular anger has been focused on Moïse since the High Court of Accounts announced on May 2019 that he was suspected of involvement in a huge corruption scandal that stretches back a decade. The ever-deepening crisis has slammed the brakes on domestic and international investment, leading to massive unemployment levels and an inflation rate topping 20%, which has made the impoverished nation even poorer. A third of the population now faces severe food insecurity, the last stage before famine, according to the World Food Program, the WFP. The country has also faced a sudden surge in the number of kidnappings for ransom, together with a rise in the usual gang-related violence in its poorer urban neighborhoods. A French employee of the WFP was freed last Thursday, 2 days after she was abducted in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince. So that's the World Food Program. Can you imagine an employee there? Unbelievable. God. One second. This is interesting as well. In France, as it happened, European Union raises the coronavirus risk to moderate to high, as the French report a third death. At the high, as the number of countries with coronavirus continues to climb, public health authorities and economic powers worldwide sought to coordinate responses. So these are the figures. Nearly 90,000 people worldwide have been infected with the coronavirus, and more than 3,000 have died from the COVID-19 illness the virus causes. Italy said it's 50 deaths, while the U.S. Toll reached 6, all in the state of Washington. And on top of that, actually, we have more cases, not deaths, but cases in New York and in Florida. And France reported a third fatality. Now, Australia and Thailand reported their first deaths on Sunday. Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, Portugal, and Iceland were among the countries confirming their first cases on Monday. G7 and Eurozone finance ministers will discuss coordinated responses to the coronavirus crisis on Wednesday, that's tomorrow. The new coronavirus has dented European tourism revenue by 1 billion euros per month. European Union Internal Markets Commissioner Thierry Breton said on Monday. And in Paris, the Louvre Museum employees voted Monday to stay off the job for a second consecutive day over the coronavirus concerns. French President Emmanuel Macron has canceled 2 planned events to concentrate on a response to the coronavirus, his office announced yesterday. The World Health Organization chief said on Monday that 9 times more cases have been reported outside China than inside over the previous 24 hours. The epidemics in the Republic of Korea, Italy, Iran, and Japan are our greatest concern. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said during a briefing. And, what can I tell you? It's mind-boggling what's happening around the world. So that's just some other issues of concern. Bear with me a moment. Wanted to check what else is happening. I think we've caught up. Looking at some other publications just to see if we're missing something that we should tell you about. It's about almost 11:30. We may just close within 2 minutes or so. I want to quickly check one other thing. Bear with me a moment. One second. All right, 1 second. All right, we'll see in a moment. Can hear. This is very interesting, actually. approximately 15 Sacramento County election staffers to are not going to work on Tuesday due to the coronavirus concerns. So I guess this is going to happen around the nation. So it's going to be very, very interesting to see where all this goes. And this is fascinating as well. The top U.S. doctor says that the coronavirus now is in an outbreak, possibly a pandemic. The doctor on the front lines of the battling coronavirus in the United States said this week that the rapid spread of the deadly bug has risen to the level of an outbreak and possibly even a pandemic. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and a member of the White House's Coronavirus Task Force, told NBC Nightly News Richard Engel on Monday that the illness, which has infected 100 people, killing six in the United States, is an evolving situation. We're dealing with clearly an emerging infectious disease that has now reached outbreak proportions and likely pandemic proportions, he said. If you look at, you know, by multiple definitions of what a pandemic is, the fact is this is multiple sustained transmissions of a highly infectious agent in multiple regions of the globe. Fauci urged the public not to compare the coronavirus to a seasonal flu because the impact of the new bug can be far worse. When you have a brand new virus in which no one has had any experience before, that kind of gives the virus an open roadway to spread, he said. He also warned of the infection's alarming mortality rate. If you look at the people who have just come down or have just come to the attention of the health authorities, that's 2 to 2.5%, Fauci said. But even if it goes down to 1%, that's still very, very serious. So if it went from 2% to 1%, it is still 10 times more lethal than the standard influenza that we get on a seasonal basis. So, look at these are the numbers. Total cases, 96. The deaths are 6. And you've got one in Massachusetts. I think it's now up to, 3 in New York, Rhode Island, 2, Florida, 2, Illinois, 4, Wisconsin, 1, Nebraska, 13, Texas, 11, Arizona, 1, Utah, 1, California, 35, Oregon, 2, and Washington, 22, with just 6 more. Those are 26, I'm sorry, cases, but there were 6 deaths there. So the deaths are definitely at the moment in Washington, in the state of Washington. So we'll see where all that goes. And that's it. What can I tell you? All right, let me just quickly look to see if there's anything else on the international stage that we can inform you of, and then we'll see where all this goes. One second. This is interesting because it has nothing to do with the coronavirus, but you might find it interesting. Woody Allen's going to set a record straight in a surprise autobiography coming April 7th called Apropos of Nothing. So it's an autobiography of 400 pages, and it'll be released by Grand Central Books on April 7th. There have been rumblings for a while that such a book existed, and unusually the book is pretty much being dropped instantly. In other words, it's too late for one of Woody's kooky enemies to stop it from hitting bookstores and e-stores. It's likely that Woody will set the record straight on the never-ending Mishigas, or the craziness surrounding his separation from Mia Farrow, his marriage to Mia's adopted daughter, Sun Yi Previn, and their own family. Woody will hopefully address the scandal around the accusation that he molested adopted daughter Dylan, and look for the Farrows to pick up, and there's more to come. So we'll have to see where all that goes, but intriguing. All right, let me just see. This is interesting. Things are really changing on the world stage. Chris Matthews has been pushed out of MSNBC after 20 years. Evidently, his approach with a particular woman was unbecoming, and she was offended. And then Timothy Hutton denies that he raped a 14-year-old back in 1983. He's got to be in his 50s now. So, Matthews unexpectedly retired. He's 74. A woman said that there was a pattern of making comments about women's appearances in a demeaning way. And so there definitely is going to be a change in the attitude and the conduct expected of men by women and of men of women. So it's going to be very, very interesting where this goes. And we'll see where it does go. All right, let's get back to our studio screen. I want to thank you for being with us today. It's been a long, long day. There's so much been to cover, so much to have covered. Oh, but before I go, let me quickly tell you who is expected tomorrow. Tomorrow, we're going to be speaking to none other than Anthony Maranti. He is the Yonkers City Council member representing District 6. He's also the, I think he holds the I think it's the finance portfolio. I'm not exactly sure what it is or how it's called, but he's involved in that. He's also a CPA, so there's a lot we're going to be able to learn from him. He'll open the show at 10 o'clock tomorrow, continue then afterwards as well. And then don't forget, tonight is Super Tuesday, and you might be able to see what's going on and maybe conceivably move on and see what the prospects are for a lot of the candidates. So it's going to be a major, major night. A lot of delegate votes are going to come in. So all the best, and thank you again for being with us today. Always a pleasure, and have a good day. Goodbye.